Listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello and good evening. This is Don Swans, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 26th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review on your Niagara Frontier radio reading service. Front page. Faster, higher, stronger, and pumped full of drugs. A new sporting competition is enticing athletes to openly use performance-enhancing drugs. Is it a grotesque spectacle or pushing the boundaries of human achievement? One Tuesday last February, alone in a pool in North Carolina, a former Olympic swimmer took exactly 20.89 seconds to prove that his highly tailored doping program was working. He was bigger, stronger, and quicker than he'd ever been in his life. And the cocktail of chemicals coursing through Christian Gholomyev's body had helped him pulverize the 50-meter freestyle faster than anyone in history. At any major competition, that turbocharged swim would have had Gholomyev thrown out and banned. Instead, it earned him the biggest paycheck of his career, $1 million. The world record wasn't recognized by any major sporting authority, nor did it officially topple the mark of 20.91, set by Brazil's Cesar Gielo in 2009. But that was the whole point. Gholomyev's backers, an organization known as Enhanced Games, weren't trying to rewrite the old history books. With investors that include venture capitalist Peter Thiel and Donald Trump Jr., Enhanced is attempting to push sports into a world of logical and physical extremes, unencumbered by the rules, regulations, or doping controls of traditional competition. They plan to host their own Olympic-style competition in Las Vegas next year, with a roster that already includes the British swimmer Ben Proud, who won silver at Paris 2024, and U.S. sprinter Fred Curley, a multiple world champion. The World Anti-Doping Agency has called it dangerous and an irresponsible undertaking. But organizers argue they are simply more transparent than the regular Olympics, and finally paying athletes what they deserve. For Gholomyev, a 32-year-old who has represented Greece at 4 Summer Olympics and the father of a toddler, the debate boiled down to this: make another 4 years of sacrifice for one last shot at a medal, or close that chapter forever for a modicum of financial security. Over 14 years as a pro, his career earnings had amounted to roughly $200,000. Gholomyev understood that widely publicized doping would mean that he would never go back to the swimming world he knew. But by the end of last year, he had grappled with the ethical quandary and come out on the side of trying something different. The Enhanced Project had realigned his entire worldview on professional sports. For this money, I probably needed 5 or 6 careers. Turning taboos into hacks. The idea for a no-testing, whatever-it-takes, free-for-all version of the Olympics has an extensive history. For as long as performance enhancement has been around, there have been thought exercises and barroom debates that ask, what if athletes could just take everything? How fast would humans run? How high might they jump? How many home runs could they crush? The philosophical arguments against it, meanwhile, have centered on sporting integrity. The idea that performance should be generated through sweat, focus, and skill, unassisted by potentially dangerous chemicals. But the enhanced games have a different read on what constitutes a level playing field. They are taking taboos and turning them into hacks. Technological advantages such as ultra-buoyant swimsuits are encouraged, and the unapologetic use of performance-enhancing drugs is a given. In fact, performance-enhancing products underpin the entire enterprise. The enhanced games have no corporate sponsors or broadcast deals. Instead, they've built their revenue model around the sale of training plans and supplements. The organization's website currently offers 3 testosterone-boosting products, which it hopes to begin selling later this year. The lawyer and entrepreneur behind it is Dr. Aaron D'Souza, who isn't a medical doctor, but rather holds a degree from Oxford and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Melbourne. Although he has spent much of his career in tech, it was his involvement in a high-stakes legal battle that first earned him attention in the United States. He takes credit for devising the strategy behind Thiel's litigation that ultimately bankrupted Gawker Media. That said, the most surprising line on D'Souza's CV is his role as the honorary consul of Moldova in Australia. I'm addicted to the action, he says. In 2023, D'Souza decided that the action was in sports. So he founded the Enhanced Games to correct what he viewed as rampant hypocrisy that left athletes not only underpaid, but also limited in their potential by constantly shifting and arbitrary rules. D'Souza, 40, speaks in the sweeping terms of a person convinced he can fix any problem. Market forces and social change, inefficiencies and revolutions. He says his dream is to one day build a $1 trillion company. Beyond that, he also believes that he can usher in new ways of living in which performance enhancement isn't reserved for elite athletes, but becomes a daily fact of life. What I'd like to be remembered for is not bringing the enhanced games to life, but bringing the enhanced age into existence. Who would want to be a human 1.0 when you can exist in the world of humans 2.0? First, though, he needed to create Swimmer 2.0. Glolomiv first learned about the enhanced games when he heard an experienced coach named Brett Hawk appear on a podcast. Hawk himself had signed up to the organization after hearing D'Souza on the Joe Rogan podcast last year. Hawk, an Australian-born former coach of the Auburn swimming team, explained that in his years of pacing the pool deck, his greatest frustration was seeing athletes earn less than they deserved. Olympic swimmers, they always struggled, Hawk says. The athletes that I trained, these are the best swimmers in the world, and they should be regarded as such. Glolomiv felt the pain sharply. After last summer's Paris Games, he was sitting at a crossroads in his career. He'd finished fifth in the 50-meter freestyle final in 21.59 seconds. Coming closer than ever to an Olympic medal in 12 years of trying. The podium was just 0.03 of a second away. So the question facing him was whether another 4-year cycle of discipline and self-denial was worth it for the chance to bridge that blink of an eye. He had no savings, no investments, and no assets. At some point, he would need to do something else. Plus, Glolomiv couldn't shake the feeling that others in the pool might not have always played by the same rules. As athletes, we know if something is sketchy or not, Glolomiv said. I was always saying to myself, give me what these guys are taking, and you know, I will be unbeatable. As it happened, the enhanced games were offering swimmers precisely that opportunity. Glolomiv talked it over with his wife, Lindsay, a former swimmer at the University of Alabama. And last fall, she reached out to enhanced by sending an unsolicited email to the general inbox. Soon, Glolomiv met Hawk, and the pair realized that they had never had so many training options available to them. Everything Hawk knew about workload and recovery times went out the window. So he did research, consulted doctors, and spent hours interrogating ChatGPT to explore this new realm of possibility. Hawk had already seen dramatic results working with the Enhanced Games first swimmer, a former Olympian from Australia named James Magnusson. Instead of taking 24 hours to recover from a workout, he'd take 12. They could train 6 days a week. They pushed so hard that the barrier was no longer physical, but mental. And as Hawk says, neurological. Magnusson was becoming a machine. By the time he began working with Glolomiv, Hawk had adjusted his plan to 5 days a week. Even so, sessions could be 20% more intense than they had been during Golomiev's career, and the turnaround times would be unprecedented. He expected to complete a traditional 12-week training block in only six. I'm thinking it's endless, Hawk says. Where's the limit? The harder part was navigating the perception from the outside world. All over the swimming ecosystem, former friends and acceptances told Hawk that he was making a mistake. He could talk about small doses and medical supervision all he wanted, but critics, including WADA, insisted that enhanced was putting athletes in danger and setting a profoundly toxic example. I've lost friends over this. I've lost colleagues, Hawk says. I wasn't native enough to think that this wouldn't have an impact. Still, Golomiev was ready to throw in his lot. In November, he decided that there was no going back. For more than a decade, Golomiev had faithfully complied with every rule of life as a drug-tested athlete. The 6 a.m. knocks on his door, the supervised urine collection, the constant updating of his whereabouts so testers could find him. All that was about to end. He contacted the anti-doping authorities at WADA to let them know. Christian Golomov should no longer be their concern. In order to figure out which performance-enhancing drugs he should take, Golomov first needed to learn which parts of his performance stood to be upgraded. Guided by his doctor in Orange County, California, he underwent a battery of tests to paint a complete picture of where he was, biologically, as an athlete. They measured everything that could be measured: his heart, his lung capacity, how he absorbed oxygen. What they found was there was plenty of room for him to get stronger. Golomiev became the protocol, as he calls it, in February by microdosing three different drugs for a short spell. A mix of steroid hormones such as testosterone or its derivatives, metabolic regulators, and FDA-approved growth hormone. He declined to name the specific products because he didn't want to encourage anyone to copy his program without medical advice. Immediately, Golomov identified a boost during recovery. He used to come home from a hard practice and vegetate on the couch, shared by exhaustion. Now it seemed as though someone had put in fresh batteries. Then came the changes he could see, not just feel. In the space of 3 weeks, he was up 5 pounds with no discernible side effects. By the end of his 2-month cycle, when he was ready to find out just how fast he might be, he had gained 13 pounds of lean muscle. When you change your body and you become stronger, it changes everything inside the water. Your buoyancy, your resistance. You need to change small things in the stroke, in your technique, because I'm much heavier in the water. Because of that, neither Glomikov nor Hawk went to North Carolina in the Cesar Cielo record, or expecting a serious attempt at the Cesar Cielo record. Even with a faster, more buoyant suit designed for open water swimming, illegal in regular pool competition, 20.91 seconds seemed out of reach. Hawk even told D'Souza that Golomiev probably needed more preparation. It wasn't worth hopping on a plane to attend in person. But from the moment Gokolomiev dove in that Tuesday. He knew he was motoring. 50 meters, one length of an Olympic-sized pool, all in a single breath. As he pounded through the water, Gokolomiev sent waves rolling into the empty lanes beside him. And when he reached for the wall, he spun around to look at the clock. 20.89. It was a time he never imagined in 2 decades of striving. It was also more cash than he'd ever even considered possible in his former life of doing things by the book. But if there was a round million printed on a giant novelty check, there it was. The reaction to Gokolomiev's swim came swiftly. There was elation from like-minded fans who shared D'Souza's views on the contradictions of modern sports. There was also a barrage of abuse from those who called Gokolomiev a cheater. Among some of his former peers, there was outright disgust. 4-time Olympic champion Leon Marchand, France's hero of the Paris Games, wrote as much under one of Gokolomiev's Instagram posts. This, he typed, is sad. The following month, World Aquatics went even further, when in the name of sporting integrity, it adopted a new bylaw that gave it the power to ban any athlete, coach, trainer, or doctor who actively supported or endorsed a sporting event or competition that embraces scientific enhancements that include the use of prohibited substances or prohibited methods. Gokolomiev would never return to official competition, even if he wanted to. Enhanced responded in August by filing an $800 million lawsuit in New York's Southern District against World Aquatics, USA Swimming, and WADA, alleging antitrust violations. The filing argues that these sporting bodies are trying to organize the de facto boycott of the enhanced games. The central element of their winner-take-all market structure is having that record book, D'Souza says. When they lose control of it, it's all over for them. That's why D'Souza is targeting as many iconic records as he can. As a sport with dozens of different events and clear correlation between an athlete's engine and his results, swimming offers plenty of low-hanging fruit. But beyond the pool, D'Souza also has Usain Bolt's 100-meter mark in his sights, and he has no doubts that the talent is there. Thousands of athletes have been in touch since the Enhanced Games project launched 2 years ago, with hundreds of potential Olympians in the group, according to D'Souza. He will need plenty of them to fill out his fields when the games come to life next May in Vegas, with events in swimming, track, and weightlifting, and lavish appearance fees and bonuses for all. Gokolomiev will be there. At that point, several cycles into the science experiment he's running on himself, he'll have just one objective: sweeping up more of the paychecks that swimming clean never earned him. Should he best his own mark in the 50-meter, he'll collect another $1 million. I know what I did in my career. I know I've been clean. It's been fair to everybody. Yeah, I have no regrets. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The next article I'm about to read is certainly moving in a different direction than what I've just read. It's entitled, "I'm Worried About Being Jewish in a Small Christian Town. Now I Feel Right at Home." It's written by Nan K. Chase, who was co-author of How I Got You Your Ounce, A Pot Dealer's Journey Through American History. When I was 30 years old, my oldest child came home from his first day of kindergarten talking about Jesus. Our family was Jewish, and this was public school in Boone, North Carolina, in 1984. The mixing of church and state struck me as inappropriate and possibly unconstitutional, and I wrote a newspaper column about the incident that hit a nerve with Jewish readers around the country. I imagined years of stifled conflict before my three children all graduated from high school. But my husband was settling into his teaching career and moving wasn't an option. So I decided not to bring unwanted pressure on my children by complaining about the mixing of church and state. 40+ years later, I regularly attend the monthly town council meeting in our adopted hometown of Freeze in Southwest Virginia. And my favorite part is the opening invocation. All 7 council members and the mayor are devoted Christians, and they invariably begin by thanking our Heavenly Father for allowing us to be together in such beautiful surroundings. It reminds me of the Jewish prayer in which we thank God for bringing us to this day. Then the speaker asks for wisdom and compassion to guide the council members toward actions that benefit all residents of the town and move the community forward. What marvelous sentiments, so simply stated. After the concluding, "In Jesus' name we pray," I join in saying, "Amen." Then the people's business commences. I love how the invocation set a calm, cooperative, even loving tone at a time when too many civic gatherings in this country are torn by ill will, short tempers, and sometimes violence. At the first council meeting after the October 7th, 2023 Hamas attacks in Israel, our town prayer leader added, "And we pray for Israel." And I was blinded in a mist of tears. My road from resisting public expression of religion to embracing them took many twists and turns. Along the way, I discovered and began to practice the day-by-day rituals of Judaism, which helped me understand the larger fabric that clothes all religions, faith. My husband and I moved to Freeze after a decade in Asheville, North Carolina, a hipster hub bursting with creative energy. But the more seriously I took Judaism, the less attractive the city became. People seem so judgmental and intolerant. Anyone who votes for Trump is trash, for example. So quick to hurl F-bombs and other offensive language. Do we not speak and pray from the same mouth? So pessimistic. Will climate change nearly kill us all in a few years? Or can we hope for innovation? Then there was the light pollution, worsening crime, and strange to say, a lot of black bears roaming the city streets. In 2018, looking for a calmer life, we moved to the country, deep in Appalachia. The very air became music. The fields and forest, a pageant of color and motion. Human life shrank to a dust mote. As in the foxhole, there are no atheists in the country. In effect, I moved to a faith community, where church provides the foundation of social life. But the fact that I attend a synagogue instead doesn't seem to matter. I get nothing but understanding when I explain to a repairman that he can't work on Saturdays because that's my Sabbath. It's been easy, uplifting to make friends. One acquaintance always answers the question, "How are you with richly blessed and highly favored?" Not everything sucks. No one says goodbye. It's have a blessed day. I enjoy having earnest conversations about religion with my new neighbors. We all learn something of value: humility, generosity, and acceptance. If Jesus gets the credit at the town council meeting, well, that's the price of the ticket, and I'm very happy to pay. Growing up and growing old with Bruce Springsteen. Me and my wife met in high school when we were just 17. That real-life fact echoes a line from Bruce Springsteen's The River, the title track from his 1980 album. I also happened to be 17 when it came out. Of course, I couldn't have imagined then that such a profound connection would endure through the next 45 years of my life and more. I just don't mean between me and my wife. I mean between me and Bruce. It's not that I've ever met him. The closest I've gotten was a 2017 show in Philadelphia, where he strode out on a ramp just a few rows from me, almost close enough to hear me singing along at the top of my lungs. But more and more over the years, I've reflected on how lucky I was to pick as my teenage musical idol someone who would still provide music and moments that mean everything to me into his 70s. Bruce was best known for the youthful rebellion of songs like Born to Run. But it turned out he was also made to last. An aging rock star is far from unique, but most are nostalgia acts, singing their hits from long ago. Springsteen, by contrast, has had more creative eras than Taylor Swift. His personas include Dylan-esque poet, Elvis-influenced rocker, high-energy bandleader, acoustic folk hero, musical faith healer, Broadway showman, and just in the last few years, country storyteller, and soul crooner. Yet, consistently, he has sung about saying and standing up for regular people and the real problems they face in their lives. From the misunderstandings of youth to the compromised dreams of middle age, to the losses and regrets that pile up in later life. Springsteen's darkest era spurred the making of his Nebraska album, a period of emotional and creative strifes depicted in the movie Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, opening this weekend. Famously, Bruce made Nebraska on his own on a tape player in his bedroom, rejecting contributions from his signature E Street Band. The spare, lonely-sounding result was a brilliant songwriting, but a difficult listen. It also was a lesson for fans like me, who took time to warm up to it. Following an artist on his own personal journey could mean more over time than demanding the same old thing. There was no tour with the Acoustic Nebraska, but when I was in college, Bruce's chart-topping breakout arrived. And that was Born in the USA. My roommate and I, two summer newspaper interns living in an apartment overlooking a gas station, turned that vinyl record over and over and performed our own versions of Tom Cruise's slide from Risky Business across the polished hardwood floor, accompanied by the chiming sound of the gas pumps under the windows. We each drove 3 hours to see him perform outdoors in Saratoga Springs, New York, and never found one another in the crowd. Since then, I've seen Springsteen around 25 times on 12 different tours. That's a modest figure compared to the most avid Bruce fans who've seen hundreds. But those live shows gave me unusual chances to connect and reconnect with people from around my life. Old friends I traveled to see for the first time in years. Co-workers hunting for scalp tickets at the old Meadowlands Arena. I even took my boss to see the boss. And I'll never forget it, what it felt like to stroll with my wife from the commuter train station in Newark, New Jersey, to the arena a few blocks away for her very first Springsteen show after more than 20 years together. In 2002, shortly before our daughter was born, Springsteen released The Rising, an artistic response to the 9/11 attacks the year before. It was viewed not only as a healing musical moment, but a late career resurgence. Now 7 albums of new original material later, it has to be classified as mid-career. Songs like Empty Sky and My City of Ruins especially resonated with me as someone who was on the Brooklyn Bridge trying to walk to work. Pardon me, folks, when the first tower fell. But there were also hopeful songs like Walking on a Sunny Day, which eventually helped to introduce my young daughter to the Springsteen soundtrack of my life. That indoctrination mission began when she was in preschool, and I turned on the car radio for the 33-minute drive to my mother's house on Christmas Eve in hopes of hearing Bruce's recording of Santa Claus is Coming to Town. In A Christmas Miracle, they played it just in time. A few years later, we happened to buy a used car in Springsteen's hometown of Freehold, New Jersey. We swung by his old street, of course. It came loaded with a subscription to the Sirius radio service, featuring a channel devoted entirely to Bruce called E Street Radio. We dubbed our car the Bruce-mobile and never played anything else on the car stereo for years. I was pleased that the song she most hoped to hear live one day was my early favorite, Jungle Land. My daughter loved and believed the mystical stories Bruce would tell on stage about how his saxophonist buddy Clarence Clemons, who he dubbed the Big Man, joined the band. By the time he could or she could join a live audience, Clarence had died, and his nephew Jake had taken over saxophone chores. Still, there was a satisfying symmetry to her first Springsteen concert. It was a 35th anniversary reprise of the River Tour, my own first. A gratifying moment came midway through the show when I noticed two gray beards in the next section looking our way. As my daughter popped and sang along too, I'm a Rocker, a deep cut that I didn't even know she knew. The pair gave me a nod and thumbs up that clearly said to me, "Way to go, Dad." I felt exactly the same. We couldn't wait for our next concert tour, but it seemed possible there wouldn't be another. For some years, I've treated each Bruce tour as it might be his last. Then the pandemic arrived just in time to derail any tour for his album, Letter to You. As he had done after 9/11, Bruce addressed the moment, doing a radio show called From My Home to Yours. His favorite songs from every genre to connect with us, his isolated fans. When he finally did return to the stage, illnesses canceled several concerts, and the show's explicit theme was near presence of death and greater distance from youth. As he put it on stage about being 73, there's a lot more yesterdays. And more goodbyes. In the centerpiece number of the concert, Last Man Standing, he He sang about becoming the only surviving member of his first band from high school. From our seats in front of the stage, it was even more of a moving moment than on the album. And then to my daughter's delight, and mine, he played Jungle Land. Let's wrap it up with this. Giving Let me share with you the other first page article. It's entitled, "Giving Birth to My First Child Was Traumatic. I Wanted a Redo." After my baby was whisked away to the NICU, I couldn't stop replaying bad memories. A year and a half later, I was ready to try again. When my first child was 18 months, I decided it was time for a redo. It's not that I wanted to replace my son, but I didn't want a different kind of birth. I did want a different kind of birth experience. His delivery had ended with doctors whisking him away to the NICU and diagnosing me with a brain injury incurred during labor. I struggled to separate parenting my child from the circumstances that ushered him into the world. I had to tell the birth story over and over again to the therapist who assessed him for early intervention, to each new doctor we saw, even though the details were spelled out in the records. Soon it became automatic, the Apgar score of 1, indicating severe distress in a newborn. The silence in the room as the doctor worked on his small body, his long days of therapeutic hypothermia treatment, and the MRI. I spent hours on end replaying the worst moments in my head. When I woke up in the morning or climbed into the car, the paralyzing smell of the hospital sanitizing wipes would come to me out of nowhere, as though I was still sitting in the NICU's stiff blue chair, watching the ventilator breathe for my child. My husband and I always knew we wanted more than one child. We both had siblings. 4 sisters for me, 2 for him. But for a while, we avoided talking about plans. It seemed crude and selfish to move on too fast. Wouldn't admitting I wanted a redo meant declaring my existing child imperfect and flawed. And if so, what kind of mother would that make me? We needed to focus on the child we already had. We found ourselves back in the hospital again with him to monitor for seizures. We learned to administer complex medication regimens and for a while measured his food on a gram scale as part of a strict medical diet. The speech therapist doled out tips for helping him overcome his speech delay. I spent days pressing a light-up toy when we saw his name to draw his attention and babbled insistently in his face so he could copy my lip patterns. The brain is plastic, experts told us. It was both a reprieve and a burden. Our parenting could affect his outcome for better or for worse. He was doing well, had learned to walk on time, and was enjoying preschool. Two things that were never guaranteed. But his success felt tenuous. If I let up on my effort, if I turned my focus away, it might all crumble. Yet hearing news of others' deliveries left me wallowing in a puddle of jealousy. One friend had her second child and sent out the usual announcement with the kind of photos I'd longed for. A baby held on her chest, the father hovering next to them with an oversized grin in the background. I cried for hours afterwards. The grief, compounded by guilt. Why couldn't I tolerate other people's joy? What was so broken that I harbored such overwhelming envy? I felt particularly aggrieved by the partners bragging about how well their wives had done, how brave and strong they'd been to deliver a healthy child. Like strength has anything to do with it. I'd yell to my husband. He'd nod, but struggled to understand my visceral response, why I took it all so personally. I knew part of me desperately wanted a chance to prove my mettle. Time will help, people tell me. But I was impatient, and I wasn't sure it would. My son was born in 2015, and after a year and a half, time had done very little. Neither had going to therapy or talking to other women who had experienced birth trauma. It was time for a remedy more concrete than words or language. I needed a full body of immersion, sort of organic exposure therapy. Maybe, just maybe, another birth would be the key. A high-risk obstetrician reassured us there was no reason to suspect a repeat of our first baby's injury. The complications we'd encountered had been flukes. A healthy birth was possible, and pregnancy was safe for me. With that assurance, I started trying to get pregnant in January 2017, around the time my son turned 1.5. By February, the telltale line appeared on the test. I was scared, but thrilled. I spent the next 9 months consumed with thoughts of giving birth, but now it was less about remembering the first delivery than preparing for the second. I wanted to master the subject, to become an expert. I scanned the online support group I'd joined for stories of subsequent pregnancies. I read academic articles about fetal monitoring and the risks and benefits of various interventions. I watched the British TV show Call the Midwife and let myself tear up when the baby was delivered and placed in its mother's waiting arms after she navigated whatever hardships had come her way. I let myself fantasize about doing the same with my baby, about hearing the cries as soon as he or she emerged instead of eerie silence. My body coursed with anxiety for the entire pregnancy. Sleep was fleeting. My heart fluttered so quickly and irregularly it made me see spots, landing me in the hospital for monitoring. I called my OB to check on the slightest twitch of pain or at all times of day or night. But I also took the time to savor the pregnancy. In the days leading up to my due date, I snapped pictures in the mirror of my belly under the tautness of a silver dress. I walked to the neighborhood bistro for lunch, and proudly slipped into the booth, feeling that heaviness I'd longed for, that glimpse of a different future. When I stepped into the delivery suite to give birth again, the room was as familiar as my own apartment. Of course it was. I'd been living inside of it for over 2 years. I preserved every last detail in my mind, the lines of blue bins along the wall with their various tools, the sound of the doors that swung open and shut, the insistent pulse of lights on the monitors, the pressure of the button under my thumb as I raised and lowered the bed. I felt dizzy, but I took a deep breath. Finally, my older son arrived. My husband carried him into the room and placed him on the bed next to me as I snuggled his baby brother in the crook of my arm. At first, he avoided looking directly at the baby. Too strange, I think, to see me with another child, but I held both of them, one on each side. With some encouragement, he leaned in. His light hair swept low into his wide blue eyes as he absorbed it all. And suddenly, he just seemed so mature, so grown. He was the big brother. He was his own person, independent from the stifling memories that he had hung over him. He was back here as a chubby, chatty toddler, not the helpless baby in the NICU. Giving birth a second time and years later a third didn't take away any of my love for my oldest son. In fact, it allowed me to separate him from the experience of his birth. I could leave the trauma, or at least the power it wielded over me, behind. It had been, or had taken another round to figure out what should have been obvious. The child was not the birth. I hugged them close. Children who had arrived in different ways, but who were very much mine. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 26th issue of the Wall Street Journal Review. We read from the Wall Street Journal Review every Thursday at 7 p.m. Your reader this evening has been Don Swans. I want to thank you for listening and wish you the very best, and hope certainly that next year, next week, next year, next week, we find you at the same place listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. God bless you all.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the New York Times. Following that at 9 o'clock, is Fortune. And at 10 o'clock, we have episode number 9 of An Inside Job by Daniel Silva. Stay with us for these readings and more. Holy cow! It's almost time for the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service Meat Raffle. It's Friday, November 7th at the Main Transit Fire Hall in Williamsville. Doors will open at 6 p.m. First spin will take place at 7 p.m. Admission is only $100 pre-sale and for veterans. $15 at the door, a table of 12 for only $100. You can purchase tickets by visiting www.nfradioreading.org or calling 716-821-5555. Meat raffles are a great Western New York tradition. Come to ours and you'll be supporting your radio reading service at the same time. If you or people you know shop at any of the Dash's supermarkets, please save Dash's register tapes for radio reading. Our agency receives $2. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,